HSBC.
Welcome to The Lisa Show with Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. Welcome to The Lisa Show.
Are you looking for ways to ask for a promotion at work? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to get going about how you can get what you want with confidence.
And celebrate a holiday today on your back. I'll tell you what the holiday is and how you can enjoy it. Coming up in your morning buzz.
We all crave authentic and genuine interactions. But is that what we actually give to other people? A lot of times we think that we're being genuine when we're actually overthinking a conversation to really ensure that the person that we're talking with likes us. And sometimes it's not just in conversation, but even in our actions and choices, they can become dictated by what we think people want from us.
Uh-huh. Was the chuckle in your voice because you find yourself doing this sometimes?
Well, I feel that we talk a lot about being a people pleaser, and I have certainly struggled with that at certain times in my life.
Sure.
But I also feel like sometimes you can sense that from somebody else, like they're just telling you what you want to hear. Sometimes my teenagers do that to get what they want, and
sure,
I can tell.
Sure.
But I mean in more subtle ways when we have conversations, and there's not really a socially appropriate way for you to sort of stop the conversation and go, no, I really just want to know what you really think.
Yeah. No, seriously.
Exactly. That's why I'm
laughing. Shoot me straight right now. Yeah, that's how I experience that too.
So how can we let go of any assumed outside judgment and just live the best lives for ourselves and encourage ourselves and all those around us to really just be authentic? Today, we're talking with Bella DiPaolo. She's an academic affiliate of psychological and brain sciences. She also writes a lot about being single and how singles are stereotyped. Welcome. Thanks for being here, Bella.
Thanks for having me.
Why is it so difficult for us to really focus on maybe what's best for us in the moment instead of really thinking about what other people want?
Well, my focus is on people who are single and people who actually thrive by being single. That's how they live their best life. Well, the pressures not to do that are enormous. The scripts we have, the way that people think about life is, of course, you look for the one, you find that one, you stay committed to that one, and that's how you live a good and fulfilling life. And for some people, that's really true. But what we've failed to recognize is that there are other people who, if they caved to social pressures, if they did what they thought they were supposed to do, instead of what really suits them deep down inside, what would really make for a meaningful and fulfilling life. The meaningful and fulfilling life for them is living single.
Okay, and so let me just interrupt you really quickly.
Sure.
When we're having conversations with people, whether we are single or married or, you know, no matter what our social status is or relationship status, I should say, we throw around the term authenticity a lot, right? And what do you think that it really means to live authentically and represent yourself and your ideas in an authentic way?
You know, it means that you're living consistently with your values and with who you really are. And it's hard to know sometimes when the pressures are so strong in one direction, like you should be coupled. But at some level, you do know it. You feel like if you're living authentically, that you're really enjoying the goals and plans that you pursue. You identify with what you're doing. You find it interesting, challenging in a way that you like. You might even feel like what you're doing, let's say you have some passion that maybe it's tied to a job, but you get to actually live out your passion in the job that you're doing. You might feel like, you know, this is so me. This is so authentically who I am that maybe even if I didn't get paid for this, I'd still want to do it. I mean, that's a really gratifying sense of personal fulfillment if you're doing something meaningful and you're not just doing it because you're going to get paid or because other people think you should want to do it, but it's you. It's
But one of the things that I think that we struggle the most with is when we're being authentic, in the event that the other person doesn't like that, there's a certain amount of vulnerability of putting ourselves out there that we go, is this going to be okay?
Or maybe I should dilute this a little.
And some people aren't ready for that feedback. So what do we do in those cases?
It is hard. But if you can do it, if you have the strength and resilience to say how you really feel, what really matters to you, even if you know you might get rebuffed or criticized or even mocked, you are paving the way for the next person. Because once you express what matters to you, somebody else who also feels the same way, that person is also going to be feeling freer to live the life that's their true life, their most authentic way of being.
We're talking with Bella DiPaolo about how to live authentically, and you mentioned that you specialize sort of in the single individuals, the single lifestyle.
Yeah.
I know one of the things that you mentioned is being single at heart. What in the world are you talking about, Bella?
Okay, single at heart. People who are single at heart are people who live their best, most fulfilling, most authentic, and meaningful lives by living single. And I don't mean anything grudging like, oh, it's better to be single than to be in a bad relationship, or it's better to be single than to wish you were. No. These are people for whom single life is their best life. They grow and develop more that way. It's a life that feels authentic. An example of how you might know is people who are single at heart, some of them have been in romantic relationships. Some have even been in relationships with partners that they absolutely adored and who adored them. And yet, it just wasn't right for them. And when those relationships ended, they might have felt sad and, you know, unhappy in various ways because there were things in the relationship that they loved, but they also felt relief. Like they were so relieved to get to go back to what was their really one true love, which is their single life.
I want to ask you about something that we mentioned a little bit earlier at the beginning of the conversation, about this idea of that sometimes we kind of in a conversation, we may be overthinking it and think we're being genuine. When we have our interactions with other people, what is that fine line between really like thinking about the point we want to get across, thinking about ourselves, and thinking about the effect that we have on other people?
Yeah, I mean, of course it's a good thing to care about the effect you're having on other people, but if you're caring about it because you just want to please them, you want them to pat you on the head or to think good things about you, and you're not really being authentic, then that comes at a cost to you. And you know, it also comes at a cost to them because they don't get to really know you. They just get to know the fake you. And, you know, ultimately, that's not going to be very satisfying.
Yeah. I would love to hear your perspective on the types of people that you feel like we should surround ourselves with and the effect that has, not just in a relationship status, but really just in that quality of authenticity.
Absolutely. You know, sometimes our friends and relatives know us better than we know ourselves, or they see who we really are quicker than we do. And to surround ourselves with people who will say what we need to hear in a way that we can hear it, that's a real gift.
People might listen to you, though, and think, great, Bella, sure, okay. Yeah, I can get on board, I can try. But they just feel like they're such in a rut, or they have talked themselves into the position that they're in and can't get out of it. What do you say to those folks?
Baby steps. You know,
baby steps on the bus. I love that movie. That's great. That's great.
Yeah, like do the first little thing you can do that gets you toward where you want to be, who you really are, what your values really are, and from there it will, you know, it will get easier. And also, again, if you are living authentically, if you're owning up to what matters to you, what you care about, especially if it's something that's not, you know, kind of the standard line about what everybody else cares about, mm-hmm. you are doing such a great, you're giving such a great gift to other people who might also feel the way you do, but think they're the only ones. When you, you know, live out loud about who you really are, then you're just creating this great path for other people to do the same. And I think everybody feels less lonely when they can be who they really are and not just who they think they should be.
Do you feel like it's appropriate if you're in a social setting and either you have found yourself being inauthentic or you find the other person inauthentic to sort of call a reset?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to do if you're calling somebody else out on that. But you can do it yourself. And sometimes when we don't want to say how we really feel, it's because we think it makes us look bad. But exposing that vulnerability, you know, owning up to something that you know might not automatically win you praise or credit, that can have, I mean, it's risky, of course, but it could also be amazingly rewarding mm-hmm. when people just feel grateful to you to get to know you as who you really are rather than who you think you should be.
Well, Bella, we are team more authentic conversations on this end, and we've really enjoyed
absolutely
the conversation that we've had with you. Bella DiPaolo is an academic affiliate of psychological and brain sciences at UCSB, has written a considerable amount for those single folks out there, how singles are stereotyped, stigmatized, and ignored, and still live lives that are happily ever after. You can find out more about Bella's books by hopping online to belladipaolo.com.
Now, a quick reminder, it's the Adventure Club. Lisa's Adventure Club is well underway. You just go to byuradio.org to enter for a chance to win an annual National Parks Pass.
And on tomorrow's Lisa Show, gonna give away yet another. Make sure that you enter to win today so that you might win tomorrow. It's the greatest planning in future fun you could possibly do.
It really is, because I have found myself over the last couple of weeks in giving away these park passes, talking to my friends and my family about different adventures that they've gone on, different national parks and state parks and what they've seen and which one is their favorite. It's a great way to really understand how big and how just gorgeous this country is.
I wish I could remember the individual's name, but I was looking on the Lisa Show over on Facebook yesterday, mm-hmm. Where we have obviously have a post about joining the Lisa's Adventure Club and entering to win.
Yeah.
And someone said, my National Parks Pass was stolen last week.
Oh, yeah.
I hope that I can win one this week to be able to replace it. And listen, I'm not saying that you've won, but I am saying that you need to enter for a chance if you're going to win that pass.
Yeah.
You
got
to go to byuradio.org. The word of the week. There's some discrepancy about how you pronounce it.
There's the right way, and then there's the incorrect way.
Interesting. Interpretation, certainly. It's camera. Or camera,
it's
depending
camera
on which part of this country you're from and how many syllables you like to throw in your words. That's the word that when you're prompted for the keyword of the week to get you extra entries, put in camera or camera.
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 It's a camera.
Doesn't it sound fancier if it's camera?
It sounds old-timey.
Now, you take a camera to your family things. You take a camera to the national parks.
All right.
Worth a shot.
I'd like to know once and for all. But I think in my heart, I do know.
We'll call John A. Camera and ask him what he meant.
Now, coming up in 5 minutes, when was the last time you asked for a raise? Well, we're going to talk about how you can do it with confidence.
And we're celebrating a holiday that, yes, you could even celebrate in a national park.
Oh.
I'll tell you what that holiday is coming up in your morning buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Are you curious about cryptocurrency? You kind of know what it is, but if you had to explain it to someone, you might get tripped up. Well, in 20 minutes, stay tuned as we learn more about cryptocurrency and how it can affect you. But first, it's time for your Morning Buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now, things that people are talking about. And this first one,
yeah.
It's been long enough that Black Widow has been out. I'm going to tell you, spoiler alert, if you're going to watch this particular video trending over on YouTube. It's yet another rendition from the folks over on Honest Trailers about Black Widow. So don't watch it if you haven't seen the movie or you would be mad about spoilers, but it's great. The Honest Trailers, obviously, is they watch the trailer and then speak into the film as to what you might anticipate or wait, why in the world does that happen in the trailer? Honest Trailers, Black Widow, is trending over on YouTube. Yermin Mercedes, 28-year-old, plays for the White Sox of Chicago. Well, did. He was rookie of the month in April, came up to the majors. They sent him down to the minors, and on Instagram yesterday said, I'm out. I quit.
Really?
I'm not doing this anymore. Forget it. Now, the folks that would be his bosses are like, we haven't heard anything from him specifically. He just put it back. He put it on Instagram.
Really?
But he's been slumping the last couple of months. He's like, listen, I had a great run. I'm out. And everyone's like, maybe he's just frustrated.
Is he stressed?
Maybe.
Somebody check in on him.
And what he said further is, imagine going to the majors and then having to go back to the minors. It's a hard pill to swallow for some. So he hopped on Instagram and said, I'm out. I've had a storied career at the age of 28. I'm out. And then finally this. A holiday you might be able to celebrate in a national park.
Okay.
It's Hammock Day or Hummock. I don't want to get in words.
I don't want to fight with you anymore.
Yeah. But that's the same syllables.
How many syllables words have?
I have one of the greatest gift I've given to myself in the last decade.
Uh-huh.
I got a two-person hammock that I sit in myself. Gives me that extra room.
So you can stretch out.
The little bag that you store, like it's stitched to it itself. You can store a cold beverage in there, or your glasses if you have readers. That's one of my favorite words too, readers.
Yeah.
You can just have it there. If you're cold, you can wrap that extra bit of hammock over yourself.
You've thought of everything.
I have done everything.
I like this. This is, hammock pro tips. I had no idea.
Consider buying a hammock today, as you might find deals on hammocks today. If you've got one in your car, there's nothing that says you couldn't hitch the the old hammock up to the stop sign and then the rear view mirror on your car. I don't know. I'm just trying to give you that opportunity to take a nap, take a break today.
Okay.
That's also what goes hand in hand with a hammock. That's your Morning Buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. Have you ever felt like you deserved a raise or a promotion at work, but pushed that feeling aside because you weren't quite sure how to go about doing it or just wanted to avoid that uncomfortable conversation altogether? It is a difficult conversation to have, and sometimes we can feel awkward initiating it with our boss or manager. But how can we initiate this conversation with confidence and get the outcome we really want? To join our conversation today, we've invited friend of the show and salary negotiation coach, Josh Duty. Josh joins us to go over how we can best have the conversation with those we work with confidence, in the most natural way, with the best outcome. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, y'all. Thanks for having me back. It's always great to be here.
Why is asking for a raise, which should be sort of an assumed, progression in a career, such a taboo topic so many times?
I think it's taboo because it's wrapped up in a couple of different things that are sort of uncomfortable. The first one is just, especially in America, talking about money is uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Talking about salary is even more uncomfortable. Probably people are probably more comfortable telling you how much they paid for their house than they are what they're making at their job. And then there's also just sort of the awkward arrangement of going to your manager, who's responsible for your pay, but also responsible for evaluating your work, and asking them, hey, can you give me more money or give me a promotion? And so I think it's just sort of intimidating because that person, in most people's lives, work lives, that person carries a lot of weight. And so you don't want to kind of make them feel uncomfortable or awkward. So you just kind of avoid it. So, you know what? I'll just wait for this to happen for me. I'm sure that I'll be recognized for my great work eventually. I'll just sit back and I'll get that raise and promotion when it comes to me. So I think those are the main reasons.
But the difficulty comes...
It's uncomfortable.
Because we think about, we sort of walk down the steps, right? Like if we have the conversation about, hey, what do we think about a raise? There are two ways that that conversation goes.
Yes or no.
You get the raise and you go, oh man, I really am glad I asked. Or no, you can't. And then it's like, oh, well, am I being valued as I thought I was being valued? Well, you know, why is so-and-so getting a raise and I'm not? Or like it.
Yeah, it
seems to me like
questions.
Such a positive or negative. You don't come away neutral from an asking for a raise situation.
No, and I would say there's actually kind of a middle ground third option there, Richie, between the two things that you mentioned, and that is a not yet. So it's not a yes, it's not a no. It's like, well, we can't do that right now. And a lot of that is, well, there's not a budget for it right now, or, oh, we just did raises, we just did budget, all that stuff. So I like to spin that a little bit differently. So yes, you're right. It is pretty binary. You know, you either get the raise or you don't at the end of the day, you know, eventually 6 months from now. Mm-hmm. But it's also a great way for you to the exercise of asking for a raise or a promotion is a great exercise for me to figure out, should I be asking for this raise or promotion? Can I build a case? I'm going to ask for more money. Can I actually build a case that demonstrates that I should be paid more than whatever my salary was when we set it last time we did it, when I was hired or at my last merit increase or whatever that was. So I think there's a lot of positive that can come from it. And that's one thing I try to emphasize is you get a lot of information. You get the experience of actually building your case and saying, yes, I am more valuable than the salary demonstrates. And I can build the case and I can ask for that additional salary. Or you say, ooh, I actually can't make a very good case for this. I'd like to get more money, but I can't articulate why I should be paid more than what I agreed to be paid.
So let's dive into that a little bit about how you know when you deserve a raise and how you self-evaluate before you start the conversation.
So I think that the two main components of a raise request. So let me zoom out for 15 seconds.
Sure.
And say my philosophy is when you ask your manager for a raise, and I've been a manager, put yourself in their shoes and realize that really what you're doing is you're giving them a homework assignment. They have a job, they're managing a team, they're managing a timeline, they're managing a project, whatever they're doing. And you're saying, hey, in addition to all the stuff you're already doing, can you look into this raise stuff for me? And so my philosophy is you hand them on a silver platter every piece of information they could possibly need to make a very good case for your raise to finance or the comp team or their manager or whoever else is involved. And so the two main components of that you want to give them are what number you're asking for, which if you know anything about my salary negotiation job offer advice, it's the opposite. Do not be the first to say a number. When you're asking for a raise, I think you should name a number. You should say, I'm making this much. I'd like to make this much. I call it target salary. That's the first piece of information.
Okay. Oh, that's a good point.
Based on market research. And the second thing is just why. So what are the things that you have done that are adding additional value that's currently not compensated relative to the last time your salary was set? So you're saying, I would like to make this much money. And the reason I should be making that much money is I'm doing these things that have this monetary value of some kind to the business, and I'd like to be compensated for some of that value.
How often, anecdotally, obviously, but how often as you work with folks do they just feel like, I should be getting more? And then when you say, well, how much more? They go, oh, I don't really know. Well, have you done any research into what other people are making? Well, no, but we just sort of have that innate feeling like it's like, more!
I think it's probably like, I'll guess here, but probably 50-50 people who feel like they should be making more and 50-50 people who are like, I don't think I'm worth any more. Or like, I shouldn't be asking for more. And for the people who do feel like they're making more, probably like maybe half of those people can articulate why they should be making more other than, you know, cost of living or inflation or something vague that isn't directly related to their job responsibilities and duties. So I think it's pretty rare for someone to just sort of have this idea in their head that, or really tangible data. Sometimes like you're in sales and you're just crushing it for the year. You're like, look, I've closed so many deals and my comp package doesn't recognize that. It's got to be adjusted. But most people, I think, just don't think they deserve a raise because they haven't really thought about it deeply. Or if they do feel like they deserve more money, it's for some kind of abstract reason that isn't connected to the actual function of their job.
Well, I trust you, Josh Adduty, as a salary negotiation coach and good friend of the Lisa Show, about not you know, when we're talking about how to ask for a raise and how to go about doing it and how to evaluate our worth and what to ask for and how to sort of research that. Now, I'd love to get your advice on, you know, what you've learned over the years as you've helped people just do this with confidence. You know, I'm sure a lot of people take your advice because, you know, you show them how to, you know, not only evaluate their worth at a company, but to know when to start having these conversations. But how do you do it with more confidence?
So I think the confidence actually comes from knowing that the outcome will be useful to you regardless of what it is. So back to what Richie said earlier, you're going to get the raise or you're not going to get a raise. And I threw the third option, which is not yet. You'll get the raise later. So if you're able to articulate why you should be paid more than you are, which is going to be based on a combination of, for example, market research, you know, what are other people who do similar jobs in my industry, in my geographic region, what are they making? Mm-hmm. What kind of value am I adding? And then the specific things that you're doing, you'll put all that together. You say, I should be making this much money doing this job for this company in this industry. And then you go ask for it. And if you get more money, that's a great outcome. If you don't get money, that doesn't feel like a great outcome, but it's a really good data point. Because if your research was correct, you are now aware that you're underpaid and that your company is not going to fix that. And so that's a good signal that maybe it's time to start looking for another job in that industry. If I have market data that says doing this job in this industry for this type of company should pay more than I'm making now, my current company doesn't want to pay me more, maybe I need to go to one of those companies who will pay me more. That's a useful signal. And then you start having that kind of internal conversation about, do I want to leave this company? Maybe I'm okay working with this company making less because I love the company. I love the team. I've been here for 15 years. Or maybe I'm ready to hit the road. And so I see it as, you know, the process itself is valuable. The outcome could be more money at your current job or maybe a nudge to go look for a place that will pay you what you should be paid for the work that you're capable of doing. But regardless, in the long run for your career, the outcome is good. And this is just a data point to help you get to that good outcome.
How much of this conversation is generational? I know certainly the media would have me to think that, you know, your Gen Zs or millennials sort of feel entitled at a certain point of working with a company. I've been here for this long. Now I should get a raise. Whereas, you know, Xers or boomers feel like it's maybe warranted based on performance. How much do you see that in what you deal with?
I think a lot of it is generational. I actually had a really good look at this. At my first job out of college, I worked for a big Department of Defense firm. And I was able to kind of look at, we called them the gray hairs. So you have the gray hairs who've been there for 20 years. They're working on a pension. They're going to retire soon. They don't have any incentive to sort of leave and improve things. They just want to hang on until the end. Whereas I wasn't going to get a pension. I had a 401k match. Mm-hmm. But why would I stick around for 25 years knowing that I'm going to get a 2% raise every year until I retire, and then I'm going to cash out my 401k. And so for me, the sort of forced optionality was built in because the structure of my agreement with that company was different. I did not have a guaranteed pension on the other side of the finish line waiting for me. And I also just think that there's more portability and more optionality because of remote work, which I've talked to y'all about before. The fact that anybody can work from anywhere now, exacerbated by the pandemic, gives everybody more options in terms of the number of companies that they can work for, and they don't have to relocate geographically to work for that new company. So it's easier to move around, and that gives workers, I think, more options and makes us have the ability to choose better for ourselves what we want instead of getting locked in and saying, well, I've been here for 10 years on a 25-year pension. I'm just going to ride this out.
You know, when we have these discussions with people in different generations, you know, it's different to sort of use different terminology or reasoning. It's another thing when there's sort of a power, you know, discrepancy, right? When you're talking between, you know, bosses and managers and employees, depending on how many years service you have. When you're approaching this asking for a raise, what other considerations do you need to keep in mind acknowledging that sort of power struggle? I think specifically I'm curious as to what if, you know, your immediate supervisor or boss is like, no, I can't do this because I've got to watch my bottom line. But maybe somebody up higher up would be a little bit more open to it. How do you know if that's an appropriate course of action?
That's really difficult. So I call that level jumping. I'm sure there's probably like a, a more specific term for it in the literature or whatever, but I call it level jumping. So you said, well, I didn't get the result I wanted going to the person who I'm supposed to go to. I'm going to go to the next person up. So I think that I wouldn't quite call it the nuclear option, but I think it's a much more aggressive option that you might take if you feel like disintermediating your manager will actually benefit you and you're okay with whatever kind of negative effects that might have. Sometimes you have to do that. Usually, and I think we've all heard, I've heard anecdotally, I've never seen real data on this, but, you know, the majority of people who leave a job, they leave because their manager stinks. They're frustrated working for their manager. And so that's a place where you're kind of at that point where you're thinking, I can't get what I want going through this manager. I feel like they're not serving my best interests. Do I want to just leave the company and go find a different role? Do I really want to try and stick this out and make it work? And I'm okay with the effects of level jumping here. In that case, I think you might go to your manager's manager. And the good news is that if you've done your homework and you've built the case the way that I recommend building it, you have a very solid case and you can demonstrate why you should be paid more or promoted. And so going that level up could be an opportunity to say, hey, I talked to my manager about this. There's no budget for it. You would do it diplomatically. But I wonder if there's an opportunity for me to continue to move forward here in terms of compensation and responsibility, maybe on a different team or in a different role, where I can be paid better while staying with this company. So I think that's an option. And I think it's an option that usually is compared to just leaving the company altogether, because for whatever reason, your manager just doesn't seem to be working with you.
Walking that question out a little bit differently, would it be appropriate if we're seeking a raise to go to our manager and say, I would like to be worth this much a year to the company. What can I do from where I'm at presently to be able to attain this much? It's still asking for a raise, but maybe in a more proactive or showing the investment that you have in the company. Do you recommend going at it that way?
Sort of. This is where there's a really kind of weird distinction between raises and promotions. Mm-hmm. When I wrote my book, I struggled with this and initially wrote a single chapter on how to get a raise or promotion and then broke it into two chapters that if you hold them side by side, look very similar. I say all that to say that I think the best way to do that is actually to say the pay follows the responsibility, not the other way around. Mm. So people like to think that they'll be promoted, they'll be paid more based on their potential. I'm going to be a rock star, so they should start paying me like a rock star. The reality is that you do the rock star work and then you start getting the rock star paycheck. Mm. So I think that the way to do that, if you're unable to make a case right now for more pay and you'd like to, is to say, well, how can I get more responsibility? That could be a promotion in terms of like actually moving up a title, or a promotion just in terms of the level of responsibility that you take on for your job. And so I think that's where you say, well, what's the next job that I could take in my career ladder that gives me more responsibility, which should therefore have more value to the company and will allow me to get paid better. So that's how I would approach that. And you would even mention to your manager, hey, I'd like to talk about, you know, what do I need to do to get promoted to this next level? Because I'd like to take on more responsibility and I would like to improve my pay. And I think the best way to do that is to do more work that's more valuable to the company. Can you help me do that? And so you bring your manager on as sort of a partner in that quest to move up the responsibility ladder and then also pull your pay up.
I love it. A small but important distinction between the two and a great discussion about how we can ask for a raise. Been visiting with Josh Duty, a salary negotiation coach, an expert in job interview strategy. If you want to find out more about Josh and his work, you can go to fearlesssalarynegotiation.com or hit him up on Twitter. It's at Josh Duty. Josh, thanks for being on the show.
Now, today we're going to be hearing about a cryptocurrency. You know, you're always talking about it anecdotally with your friends and, hey, do you have this?
You got some Doge? You got some Doge, bro?
If you are confused, we're going to lay it all out for you.
Hoping to get some answers to some very complicated questions. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
If you're old enough to remember when cell phones could first connect to the internet or when you got Wi-Fi in your home,
bong.
You're in the same boat as a lot of people who are just working to keep up with the latest technology trends. But even if you consider yourself an internet native, I mean, there's a lot of technology that stumps even the most tech savvy. Now, what about cryptocurrency? What is it? What does it actually mean, though, for the average everyday person? Well, we decided to get a tech expert here to give us a better idea, sort of lay it all out, because there seems to be more options than I was aware of. And just in conversations with other people, I'll say, tell me in two sentences, you know, what this is. And most people I find cannot do that.
Well, it's not. Well,
yeah.
It is sort
they
of.
Tell me what it's
not.
It's
kind of like.
Andrew J. Hacker. Yes, that's his real name. Is an expert on AI, cybersecurity, blockchain and cryptocurrency. Thanks for joining us, Andrew.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay, well, we appreciate you being able to lay this out for us. So I'd love to start our conversation with just some basic definitions of what we're talking about.
And Lisa means basic, because we've tried to do this before, Andrew. And here's what we come away with at the end of these segments. Do you understand that anymore? No, I don't understand that anymore.
So we want to get the lingo straight. Okay, so like, you know, crypto, coins, tokens, all of that. What do
sure.
we need to know?
Yeah, well, I think the most basic thing is to understand what blockchain is. So blockchain is essentially a trustless network of computers, of peers, they're called, right? Where any computers, if you've got the blockchain or cryptocurrency software on your machine, you can connect to that network and anyone can do it, right? So that sets up a network globally across, you know, different countries where anyone who has that software can plug in and participate in this network.
And what do you mean trustless?
Well, trustless means that I don't really have to know who's on the other side or trust that person in order to interact with this network, because it's really the network that handles how all of these computers interact with each other. So, you know, if, for example, you know, I have a bank, or, you know, if I'm exchanging something with any person, I have to, trust that if I give them something, they're going to give me something
okay.
in return. And in fact, you know, in the banking system, you know, with credit cards, obviously, there's a lot of theft. There's a lot fraud, and that actually, you know, adds fees and costs into that banking network. So, you know, with cryptocurrencies and blockchain, essentially what we're doing is we're creating a network where if I send you something, it's definitely getting sent to you. And in fact, there's no way for you to reverse that, you know, obviously, unless you want to give me my Bitcoin back. But once I send it to you, it's sent, right? So this cuts out, you know, a lot of fraud. It cuts out a lot of sort of intermediaries or people in the middle that charge a lot of fees, right? If you think about, you know, how the financial system works now, you pay a lot of fees for almost everything you do, right? Whether you're
sure.
taking money out of your ATM, you're getting charged fees. So I think that's the most, you know, basic usage of blockchain and cryptocurrency, and really should designate the difference between a blockchain and a cryptocurrency. So we can think of the blockchain itself is sort of the operating system, and the cryptocurrency is essentially the software that runs on top of it.
Okay.
So maybe that helps.
That helps a lot.
So let me reflect back some of what it is. So the blockchain is sort of the system, then different cryptocurrencies would be like Ethereum or like Dogecoin. Those are different currencies that reside in the blockchain software.
Correct. Yeah. And in those cases, and that's great. You've mentioned a couple of, you know, pretty famous cryptocurrencies. They each have their own blockchain. So Bitcoin has its own blockchain. And if you want to participate in Bitcoin's network, you download Bitcoin software. So if you want to do Dogecoin, you would download Dogecoin's software and install that on your computer. So, I mean, you can connect to that network yourself on your computer, but you can also have access by buying and selling those on what's called cryptocurrency exchanges. So, you know, I could put $100 in and buy some Dogecoin if I wanted to. Some of the more popular exchanges, Coinbase is to me one of the ones that's most user friendly. Binance or some other ones. We're actually listed. We have our own cryptocurrency called THT. We're listed on an exchange called CoinMetro.
So when cryptocurrency was first developed, what were they trying to accomplish, and is it actually being used for that purpose right now?
So when Satoshi Nakamoto, I'm sure some people may have heard his name as sort of the mysterious creator of Bitcoin, and there's some speculation as to whether he's a person or an organization or a group of people. When he first published sort of, they call it the white paper, the Bitcoin white paper, that sort of laid out this new idea of a peer-to-peer trustless cash system, cash transfer system. It was essentially just that. It was a way to create a network where anybody could transfer this coin to each other, you know, without anybody in the middle, right? So that was definitely the big, you know, the big promise of Bitcoin, and it established this blockchain. And then from there, kind of, you know, the whole ecosystem just exploded. The biggest thing that Satoshi Nakamoto did was he made his blockchain code essentially open source, and that mm-hmm. means that anyone can access to, anyone can take and change it. They can, you know, change parameters, and that's exactly what happened. So from that initial Bitcoin software that people started using, and they, you know, a lot of people looked at it and said, "Wow, this is really revolutionary. I mean, this is extremely innovative. This is sort of the new way of things." So, you know, certainly with respect to financial systems and store of value. And everybody started grabbing it and, you know, building on it and creating new things on top of it. And, you know, now there's, you know, probably over 3,000 different, not necessarily blockchains, but also digital assets out there based on that technology. So it's really, really taken off.
Wow. When you hear people talk about cryptocurrency and especially investing in cryptocurrency, it's that it's so volatile, right? Ups and downs. Someone can say, hey, I made $50,000 in just a very small investment today, and tomorrow they yeah. have, you know, the it's not as good as the receipt that they got from the grocery store as far as right. value goes. Why is it so much that way currently?
Yeah. And cryptocurrency, there's a couple components to that. One is, you know, certainly, you know, the technology is still new, right? Even though, you know, I think we can say for the for the most part, it's been around 3 to 5 years, you know, Bitcoin since 2009, 2010. But, you know, it's only in the last couple of years that cryptocurrency and the related industry, if you want to call it an industry, has been around. So I think, you know, as time goes on, things will become more stable. But you're definitely correct. There's a lot of volatility in there. And, you know, certainly, you know, as all, you know, new cryptocurrencies come online, they get big, they grow real fast. And then, you know, even in some cases, it could be because of a software glitch. There's been, you know, some cryptocurrencies.
Oh, wow.
There's been, you know, huge amounts, and then something happens, and then, you know, the price just drops real fast. And even, you know, there's a lot of influence by a lot of, you know, celebrities, so-called, that are involved in this that, you know, talk about this cryptocurrency. Obviously, you've heard about Elon Musk and Dogecoin and, mm-hmm. and even Bitcoin. I mean, he's got that kind of star power where he can make the price go up and down just based on a tweet. So, yeah, I mean, advice for people that are getting involved is, you know, really just do your homework. I mean, look at the fundamentals of that cryptocurrency. What are they trying to do? The team, is it solid research behind it? You know, and don't put money in that you don't expect to lose. So I like any investing advice, which I am not qualified to give, obviously.
We're talking with Andrew Hacker, CEO and founder of Thought AI, about cryptocurrency and just sort of laying it all out and how it can have application, I think, to sort of average Joes like ourselves.
There are a lot of people that push against cryptocurrency
yeah.
and its popularity. Why is that?
Well, you know, I think it's with any new technology that gains a lot of traction very fast, and certainly, you know, things that are very innovative. You know, there's a way of doing things, and anything that might affect how things are done on a day-to-day basis and changes that dramatically and drastically, you know, I think there's always going to be pushback. I mean, you know, there's pushback about energy usage of cryptocurrencies. And, you know, even though in some cases cryptocurrencies are doing a lot to sort of, you know, push forward better use of renewable and green energy sources. So, I mean, I think you're always going to have detractors. I mean, it's like any new technology. I mean, it changes the way things have been done into a mm-hmm. new way. And so there's always kind of that sort of that struggle. But in the end, I think it just makes the cryptocurrency and blockchain technology stronger, because the people that receive that pushback are going to innovate around mm-hmm. that and make things better.
Well, I love that idea of innovation, and certainly that you can see that in different markets. And I'm wondering if for just a second, we can go back a little bit about kind of like the practical applications of cryptocurrency. You know, for people like, I've never bought or sold or traded or anything, you know, or mined anything like that. And knowing that this technology is going to continue to, you know, gain traction with lots of people, how is it being used now for these kinds of transactions, you know, and what do you think that that will mean for most, say, Americans in the future?
Right. Well, I mean, the simplest version of cryptocurrency is really, you know, I can trade a coin, right? I can buy and sell a coin. I can transfer a coin from, you know, me to someone else. The interesting thing, even a lot of retailers and other businesses, they're really starting to look seriously at cryptocurrency. I know some local retailers here in Pennsylvania are actually, you know, starting to accept cryptocurrencies. So, you know, at its most basic, it's a form of payment. The more interesting things is when you start talking about programmable money and you start talking about smart things like smart contracts on Ethereum, or even in the case of what we're doing is we're applying cryptocurrencies to artificial intelligence algorithms and the value of actual information and your data. So, I mean, that's kind of, you know, as things progress and the technology matures more and more, it'll be able to do more interesting things.
Wow.
So, I mean, just to give you an example of some use cases, I mean, you know, you could buy and sell things like carbon credits. You can, you know, buy and sell, you know, maybe the solar energy that you're producing on your house, right? You can sell that back to the grid. And, you know, not that those things don't exist without cryptocurrency, but it facilitates the process, right? And anywhere where there's, you know, a lot of exchange of information, things like supply chain, you know, you grow agricultural products, they go through a whole supply chain of, you know, getting transported to the people that produce the products all the way, you know, to the retail stores and then to your table, so-called, you know, farm to fork. So using cryptocurrencies and those areas, and that's actually a space that we're in, you know, it makes that whole process more efficient. It allows us to really look at the data and the information and how everything flows, improve quality, you know, and reduce delivery times, all, things like that.
Two things, Andrew. One, I appreciate that you have made this a conversation that I've understood. I was being serious when I mentioned before that we have tried to do this conversation previously. In fact, one of our guests said, yeah, I want to explain it to you like a five-year-old. And we got to the end and went, what did that guy even talk about? So that would be the first thing. But I know that we have really just touched on a lot of these things.
Yeah.
People may be thinking, oh, you know, it's time. I want to be able to at very least know more about this. This conversation has served as a great onboard point. There are so many opinions and ways that people are getting information about it. Is there a good standard of where people can learn more about cryptocurrency?
Well, certainly our company, Thought AI, is, you know, we're doing a lot with artificial intelligence, and, you know, we're certainly happy to help, and we've got resources on our website, thoughtai.org. But, yeah, I mean, it's really just, you know, you can start by looking at some cryptocurrency exchanges if you want to purchase some cryptocurrency, but you know, almost every major cryptocurrency project does have a website where they, you know, kind of show what they're about, what they're doing, and you know, you can. That's a good place to start. Is, you know, even just pick Bitcoin and you know, start reading about Bitcoin, and there's so much information out there. But you know, really, my advice is just get started somewhere. You know, whether, you know, do a Google search on a cryptocurrency you've heard about. You know, see what comes up, follow the links, do some reading. And then diving in with both feet, maybe, you know, go to an exchange and, you know, spend $100 and buy a couple fractions of a Bitcoin, and I think you're good to go.
And then my last question for you is a little bit selfish in nature.
Oh, dear.
But I need to know, it goes back to your name, Andrew Hacker, or your
I knew,
you know,
you wouldn't be able to
no,
just
I
sort
can't,
of let
I can't,
it go.
I can't resist it that people call you Mr. Hacker. Is it a thing that from your youth you just were like, well, it's predetermined. I wanted to be a baker, but I guess I have to be in this space.
Yeah, that's funny. A lot of people have asked me, because I did have a career in cybersecurity before creating this company, and everybody said you must have changed your name.
Yeah.
No, yeah. I mean, I guess it must be a little bit destiny. It's you know, that is our last name. It always has been. And, you know, I guess we had that last name before the internet and cybersecurity became a thing. So
I love it. Well, thank you for taking the time to really lay out cryptocurrency for us. You know, what it not only was intended to do, where it's going now. I mean, it's here to stay and it's going to affect our lives in big ways, even for those digital immigrants like myself. Yeah. So thank you so much for your time, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on again.
Andrew Hacker, also known as Mr. Hacker, CEO and founder of Thought AI, which is an artificial intelligence platform that's working to make strides in tech when it comes to adaptive systems and cybersecurity, cryptocurrency and blockchain. And you can learn more about him and about how what he's up to at thoughtai.org.
You can also hop over to BYURadio.org, where we would encourage you to invest in yourself. Are you ready for this?
Oh, I am.
Did you like this
segue? I liked that
segue. Invest in your future, in the memories that you have with maybe just yourself.
Sure.
Nothing wrong with, you know, doing a little solo trip, a time for personal reflection as you look over the vast, I don't know, I was trying to paint a picture and then I realized I don't know what I would be looking over. You're looking over Glacier National Park, hiking to a glacier, being
like
able to feel
idea.
The cool breeze off of that, the road to the sun. Maybe you're traveling to Joshua Tree National Park and you think, that's not the Joshua Tree from U2, where I want to see that tree.
Wrong trees on that album. Sorry, yeah. Guys. Spoiler.
Wrong National Park. That's the one down the road. Go to BYURadio.org and enter to win as part of Lisa's Adventure Club.
You know, there are a lot of different ways that you can enter to win, and we'd certainly love for you to share it on social media and share the love. Maybe have those conversations with your family and friends about where you guys want to go. Like, hey, should we plan a cousin's trip? Yeah. Should we have a girl's trip? Sure. A bro trip? Is that what you call it?
Yeah, a bro.
I was going to say.
Bros weekend? Bros weekend in the National
You can share
Park.
It, and there are ways to get additional entries. You can enter in a word of the week. This week's word is camera.
You said it with three syllables right there.
Camera.
There, camera, two. You're saying two. I'm saying it's three. We have no official verdict on it yet. C-A-M-E-R-A is the word. Say it how you would like. In fact, you don't even have to say it. If you just want to enter those letters in the blank field that asks for the word, that way you can be friends of both Lisa and I.
Yeah,
you don't
okay,
have
good.
To pick a side. That's what I mean by that.
We're giving away one annual National Parks Pass every week this summer. And then at the end of the summer, we're giving away a grand prize where we're also throwing in a $500 Visa gift card. So every time you enter for a chance to win, you're also included in that grand prize drawing as well.
So maybe you don't win this week. You're still entered for next week. Guess what? You're still entered for the one after that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So be sure that you go to BYURadio.org and enter today. You will not win tomorrow if you do not enter or have not entered by today. Coming up, we're going to be hearing from the cast of a brand new movie in theaters now, Once I Was Engaged.
Sounds great.
I've heard very fine acting.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show with Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. Welcome to The Lisa Show.
Do you ever finish your financial planning exhausted and still not confident in your future? Coming up in 20 minutes, join us as we help you make a more stable plan for you and your family.
And you're right, that is a big horse. Mm-hmm. That is a big horse trending online. We'll talk about just how big. Coming up in about 15 minutes. It's an exciting week here on The Lisa Show. Well, because there is a movie that comes out this week, and it stars one of our very own. You're thinking, no, not me, Richie. It's Lisa, Lisa Valentine Clark, in a brand new movie called Once I Was Engaged. It's no surprise that we have Lisa able to be a part of this, but also we have the director of the film, McLean Nelson, and also one of the other actresses from the movie, Haley Jo Smith. You guys, thanks for being here on The Lisa Show.
Thanks for having us, Richie and Lisa.
We're excited. Thank you.
Now, there will be plenty of time for me to ask questions of Lisa, who has asked that I sort of guide us through this film. But for people who may not have ever even heard of the Once I Was franchise, McClane, what is this a story about?
So this is a sequel to a movie we made a few years back, which was called Once I Was a Beehive. It was a coming of age story of a bunch of young women that went to like a summer Bible camp. And it was set in the Church of Jesus Christ, you know, young women's group. And it was about a girl who wasn't a member of that church that was coming to this camp, and kind of, they just learned something from each other, and they grew and they loved and they shared and they laughed. And it was a movie that really kind of, you know, hit the heartstrings and hit the, you know, hit the funny bone. And it did well enough that over the years, people were kind of asking for a sequel. And so we kind of put our heads together, and I pitched an idea about what if we do a story about one of the girls getting engaged. There's, you know, that time of a young woman's life where she's, and young man for that matter, like deciding on college and deciding on, you know, in the Church of Jesus Christ, whether you're going to go on a mission or not, or, you know, and then when you're dating, like when marriage comes into that, it's a big, big deal. And you're making these huge decisions at a very young age that will affect the rest of your life. And there's never really been like a movie that dealt with that and kind of showed the world like what makes our culture tick and you know, kind of the fun and also the drama of all that. So we said, let's do Once I Was Engaged. I wrote a script. Lisa and Haley gave me amazing notes to make it way better. And I took those notes and, you know, made it better. And you know, so we wrote the script, and then we sat on it for a while, and then the pandemic hit, and none of us had work in film. And so we kind of decided to make our own work, and we made this movie during the pandemic. And anyway, now it's ready. We're ready to share it. I probably gave way too much info there. I don't think I over answered your question, but that's kind of the history of this project.
Well, people will remember there was a short time last winter during the pandemic when Lisa, you said, "Hey, peace out. I'm going to Hawaii. Take care of the show. Have a good time. Yep. I'm drinking fresh orange juice." Tell everybody, if they don't know, who you play and your character and interaction with this film.
Yeah, I play Carrie Carrington. In Once I Was a Beehive, she is the young women's leader who plans camp and executes it and gets really into all the details because she loves so much. And so then in Once I Was Engaged, she sort of turns that enthusiasm and love into planning a wedding for her daughter and gets, you know, I think everyone can sort of relate to that, whether you've ever been a bride or the mother of a bride or gone to a wedding, you know, that sometimes things can get out of control with the details of a wedding. And so the thing that I like about Carrie Carrington is that she's going to make it the best, you know, on a budget, and she's going to do it right. And get all of her friends and family to help.
And Haley Jo, where do you come into all this?
Well, in the first movie, I played Carrie Carrington's first counselor, which is kind of her helper to plan camp and to help her out with everything. And I think because of that experience in the world of the movie, they became very close. And so in this movie, I'm helping her out just kind of as her best friend. You know, it was definitely acting, since, you know, I just, you know, Lisa, working with Lisa, I mean, she's such a celebrity, like, around these parts. I mean, just to, like, get to work with her was just, like, it was so intimidating. And, like, okay. I'm still nervous, like, to be on her show. Like, I don't know. It's, I hope she still wants to be my friend after this is all said and done.
Haley's giving me a hard time because we are really best friends in real life. And this is just sort of a dream come true. And I do need to say, too, that Haley is responsible for the creation and the name of Carrie Carrington. So she's given me this really great, great gift.
Well, people will know that you guys are best friends, basically, because you said that. But also, they see McClane's face and they go, "Hey, wait, isn't this just a reunion of the BYU TV show Show Offs?" you guys have worked together before in a lot of situations. Is this just another project and fun thing that a big group of friends are doing? Maybe take that to you, McLean.
Absolutely. No, I go out of my way to work with Lisa and Haley. I my life's goal is to set up projects and pitch shows with them in mind, to cast them and to use them. And, you know, Show-Offs was like that from day one when I pitched that. You know, they were always a part of the pitch. We've been doing improv together since 2004. And it's, you know, it's been a, you know, more than just a friendship. It's been like an eternal bond. It's like, it's family, and they're so talented. So yes, I'm constantly figuring out how I can get them into any of the movies I do, and also writing scripts for them. And I will continue to do that because they're so great. It's so easy to write for someone you know so well. Like writing for Carrie Carrington is such a blast because I know exactly how Lisa's going to say it. You know, so I could, you know, I want to do a whole TV show about this character and these relationships. So yes, it's just an extension of our friendship. And, you know, luckily we're in a business where we are creating things together. And so our friendship can also be work related as well.
If people are just joining the conversation, we're talking with Haley Jo, Lisa Valentine Clark, and McLean Nelson, all affiliated with the new film, Once I Was Engaged. It comes out this week, so people can be able to see it if you're in the Intermountain West, or you can request it if you go to onceiwasengaged.com. Now, Lisa, you talk frequently on the show about how you have 392 children, but none of those children are married. As you sort of are exploring that within this character of Carrie Carrington, how much of it is what you suppose you'll feel like as one of your kids kind of down the road decides to get married?
Oh, I think a lot because, yeah, like I remind my kids, I mean, I don't know if I'll ever get to play this role in real life, so I guess I'll just do it in a movie. But they love that. They're like, we're too young. And I said, I know, I'm just kidding. But no, it is really fun to get into the mind of a character and to play around in that sort of world of doing it, because she is so good at planning and the details and just showing love and being enthusiastic. And listen, I think we all know someone like Carrie Carrington, right? Who is just like a little much and gets a little too intense, but it's with good intentions as well. And so I think because she's so accessible across like different sort of cultures, you know, everybody knows somebody kind of like it, then she becomes, it's an easy place just to go and relax and sort of laugh with her, because she knows she's a little bit ridiculous, but she doesn't care.
Do people have to see the first film to enjoy the second one, Haley?
No, I don't think they do. I mean, if they would like to do their homework before watching this movie, it is available, Once I Was a Beehive, on Amazon Prime or YouTube. But no, I think you can really watch this movie without having seen the first one, and I think it's different in other sequels from other sequels in that regard, because the characters just are very well fleshed out in this movie. And you kind of, you know, if anything, get to know them a lot more, many of them. And then the characters from the first movie, I mean, the actresses who play those characters, they all know their characters so well. And so they were able to, even though they didn't get as much screen time in this movie, they just felt, you know, so a part of it, because they all just brought so much to their characters, and again, just know them so well, did a lot of fun improv, and it was really fun to just bring that back. But yes, I think people can just watch this and get to know everyone for the first time if they haven't seen the first one.
McLean, what's the importance of creating a family-friendly film, something that all ages can go and enjoy? Not every director decides to do something like that. In fact, some would maybe turn their nose up and away from things like that. Why is that important for you on this project to have something accessible for everyone?
I think for me, the reason why I want to make stuff that's family friendly is because when I look back at the movies that I quote the most and the movies that I enjoy the most and the movies I want to rewatch, they're all family friendly movies. They're all things that you can just pop in with a group of people and laugh with your grandmother and laugh with your niece or nephew or your wife, or, you know, like, it's just kind of, it's a really hard movie to make a movie that is family friendly, but also everybody likes. And so I like the challenge of that. You know, so like you look at my favorite movies of the world, Princess Bride goes on there. You know, it's this amazing, wonderful story, but also very family friendly, you know, and so that's kind of like, that's the challenge. And that's what draws me to this space.
You made the movie during a pandemic and you left me in the studio, Lisa, joking aside though. What was that like interacting with various actors and being on set during a global pandemic?
It was very stressful. It was, it was stressful, but it kind of like turned our creativity to a 10 because we always had to have a backup plan if something happened and if somebody got infected. And we were very, very careful. You know, we were testing actually more than you need to really, because I just wanted to be super safe. In Hawaii, we had a full kind of like bubble system where we were all, we had negative tests, and then we were all in a bubble and not interacting with people outside that had not been tested. But when you have that kind of extra level of awareness and being, you know, nervous about that, you kind of like, you have to compensate with an extra level of creativity and an extra level of, you know, dedication to, we got to make this work. So I think it really heightened things. And I think it, you know, it, the fact that we were able to be together in that bubble in Hawaii gave us like an amount of joy, an amount of peace, an amount of like, just a solid, enough of solitude that we really were able to kind of relax a little bit and just be us, but like still being like on point the whole time. I don't know if that makes sense, but it was like nothing else I've ever experienced. So it's even hard for me to really, really describe.
Haley, is there a favorite part that you're looking forward to having audiences see? I don't want spoilers, obviously, but if there's maybe like, I love this and I can't wait to see how people enjoy this part.
Well, just the performances. I mean, I have a lot of favorite things, but I mean, I just am delighted by so many of the performances. There's just so much magic that happens when, I mean, you read a script and you try to imagine what these characters will be like in the movie. And then when the actors come and they bring their interpretations, I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, of course, Lisa is just beyond, like, she just crushes it. I mean, you all love her already, but I mean, you'll love her even more in this movie. And we have Bart Johnson from High School Musical fame, who played Coach Bolton in that movie. And he plays Carrie Carrington's husband, and he is delightful as well. And our, of course, our leads, Claire, Anita Prum, and Tanner Gilman. I mean, they're just adorable and just such good actors and really pull at your heartstrings. And so I'd say the performances are my favorite aspect.
I'd like people to know that it is time. It's time to go back to the theater. We've been careful and it's going to be hot this week. And so going into a nice, cool movie theater and laughing and just knowing that you can go to a movie and have a good time and really just laugh and see this kind of romantic comedy with a bunch of friends, I just think is such a gift that we're ready to have right now.
People can check it out, likely in the Intermountain West, playing at a local theater near you. If you don't happen to find yourself in the Intermountain West, or you'd like to schedule a screening and have it be played in your particular area, you can go online to onceiwasengaged.com and be able to coordinate with them to get it to a local theater. I've been joined by Lisa Valentine Clark, star of Once I Was Engaged, Haley Jo Smith, star of Once I Was Engaged, and McLean Nelson, director of Once I Was Engaged. You guys, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up in about 6 minutes, we're going to discuss how to include insurance in your retirement plan.
I say that horse right there, that's a couple stories tall. Okay, maybe it's not that big. Big horse trending online. It's your morning buzz coming up.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. Have you ever been to Lake Mead? In 20 minutes, we're going to hear all about it as part of Lisa's Adventure Club. But first, time for your morning buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now, things that folks are talking about, and certainly there is a buzz about these things.
Well, yeah.
The first one, you know, remember that couple's gender reveal party that started the fire in the West?
Which one?
The deadly wildfire. The one that now they've been charged with 30 crimes, including involuntary manslaughter for the death of one of the firefighters. They could face up to 30 years in prison. They're in court, and that's trending online right now. And also wildfires. The wildfires that are happening in the American West, including one burning in Oregon that's currently the largest in the United States, are creating hazy skies. Oh, not just for us here in the West, as far east as New York City. The smoke has gone up into the air nearly 6 miles and has blown over the eastern part of the United States. So people in the east are coming out and going, wait, what is it? What's going on? Oh, it's Oregon, you know, the other part of the continent. They're bad. I heard the fire is something like 38% contained. Firefighters from all over the West going to try and help them get that under control. And then finally this. Weighing in. Wait, I should do this way.
Okay.
Weighing in at 2,000 pounds.
2,000?
Standing at over just 8 feet tall.
The 7-year-old Phantom. That's right. Phantom is the name of the horse that is trending online right now over on TikTok. It looks comically large.
Really?
You know like the checks that we pay people who win sweepstakes and you're just like, no check is really that big. That's how big this horse looks. It's a massive, massive, beautiful 2,000-pound, 8-foot-tall horse. One of the largest in the world. Phantom trending online right now. And that's your morning buzz.
Thank you, Richie T. How much time do you spend organizing your finances? Everyone's in a different situation, right? Maybe you and your spouse have separate accounts, or maybe you have one big pot. Maybe you're on your own. Maybe you divvy up some to the side to save for your kids. But no matter what you do or how you slice it, each of us should be spending a decent amount of time making sure we don't run out of money anytime soon, and to make sure that we are covered in those what if kind of scenarios when disaster strikes and you're in a hard spot. Is your insurance arranged to cover your issues without driving you bankrupt? Now, personally, this is something that I feel very strongly about. So I'm really excited that we can have a friend of the show, Larry Sprung, founder of Midland Financial, on. He's a certified financial planner to really walk through the worst case scenario that, unfortunately, I have walked through and gotten to the other side with some really good information that everyone should know, no matter what their situation. Thanks for being here, Larry.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lisa. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, for those who are sort of unfamiliar, unfortunately, my husband was diagnosed about 5 years ago with a terminal disease, and as a result, ended up on permanent disability with a very expensive, many services not covered by insurance, like health insurance kind of disease, and ultimately passed away a little over a year ago. The tragedy aside, another component of this that I have found myself talking about and thinking about in the year and having so many discussions with friends and family is, are you prepared? This is me, you know, being that friend, that sister, that nosy neighbor. Are you prepared for your own sort of worst case scenario with the right kind of insurance or trust fund or accounts? Is everything financially in place so that if or when disaster strikes, you're prepared? Fortunately for us, we were in a pretty good situation, but I realized that in a lot of ways it was a miracle. And so I am anxious for others to benefit from what I've learned and what I've benefited from, because it happens so much more often than you think, and it can really give people peace of mind. So I feel very passionately about this. And I'm wondering, Larry, what your perspective is about good financial planning and how it benefits families.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Lisa, again, I'm sorry for your loss and the challenges you've had over the last several years. As you already know, life insurance, disability, and later in life, long-term care, mm-hmm. are all components of, or what should be components of, a good, sound financial plan. What you find is many of us talk about and think about the just the financial aspects of things, the balance sheet. You
exactly.
know, how much money have we saved? Are mm-hmm. we on path to save enough for retirement? But as you've experienced and you can see, you also have to think about, well, what protections do I have in place should something go awry or something unexpected take place? You know, I call it critical financial events. Mm-hmm. There are critical financial events that could and may potentially impact all of our lives. Some of them are good. Some of them are things like, you know, birth of a new child, buying a home, you know, things like that.
Going back to school.
Sending a child to college, things like that. And then some of them are, you know, like what you experience, right? A disability, a life event where you lose somebody, you know, prematurely, or a health event. And these can be protected. So as much of time as we spend accumulating the assets, we also have to think about and have things in place in order to protect the assets. And life insurance, disability, and again, later in life, long-term care are three things that can be used to help put that protection in place.
So let's drill down on those a little bit. When should we be getting them? How much should we get of each of these things? Where do we go? Do we get them from our car insurance person? How do we get into these things?
Yeah. So first of all, I always recommend, you know, whether it's a firm like us or another firm, I would always recommend speaking with a fiduciary advisor. And if you Google it, a fiduciary advisor is somebody that has to act in your best interest. I would not, you know, necessarily utilize a commission, broker, because they essentially just have to do what they think is right. Know the client, know the customer. You want to work with a fiduciary who always has to act in your best interest, like an accountant, like your doctor, like your lawyer. So that's who I would speak with about this. And as far as, you know, how much and things of that nature. So there are a couple of things that should be, and when you should get it. The first thing is, you know, not everybody needs insurance. I mean, at a point where you have a life event, it should be, you know, kind of reviewed at that point. If you get married, you buy a house, things of that nature. Mm-hmm. I don't know that a kid or, you know, a college student necessarily needs life insurance at that point. But certainly if they get married or buy a house at that point, that's the type of life event that would trigger, a life insurance conversation, certainly. Disability, when you start having a family, you know, that certainly would kick in that conversation as well. In regards to how much, there are a number of different ways of kind of calculating it. Mm-hmm. You could look at, you know, there are some things out there that say, you know, a rule of thumb, take 5 to 10 times your earnings or what the impact would be if you were to pass. Mm-hmm. Take that number. Some strategies are to take a present value of your future income stream. You know, it's more of an art than a science to figure this out. It's really figuring out what level you're comfortable with and what insurance coverage you feel comfortable with, and looking at what debts would be needed to be paid if you were no longer here also. So, you know, there are people that take a various number of approaches. None of them are wrong. They're all just different. And it's a matter of what makes you and your family most comfortable. I will tell you, one of the most overlooked components of this conversation mm-hmm. that we find a lot is the conversation usually goes or starts around if there's two spouses and one does not work, for example, mm-hmm. A lot of times it's about the working spouse. Mm-hmm. And you really have to think about insurance from a standpoint of both the working and the non-working spouse. Because if you think about it, if you have kids, the non-working spouse will typically be your child care, raising the kids. So if something happens to that non-working spouse, there's still going to be a financial hole there that needs to be filled.
Yeah, because by definition, they are actually working. And,
correct.
And those services cost money.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. So forget about the emotional piece. You still have to replace that child care.
Yeah.
So, you have to concentrate on both spouses. They may be different levels of insurance. but it should be, thought about on both the working and non-working.
Absolutely. Okay, so we have touched on disability and life insurance. What about the long-term care kind of insurance?
So long-term care is something that, I feel that you could, wait till later in life. That's something you can start approaching, as you near or get in around the age of 50. That's something you can take a look at. There are some life insurance policies today that weren't around 10, 15 years ago that have long-term care benefits attached to it. Those are permanent policies, which we haven't even talked about. Mm-hmm. You can't get that with a term policy, permanent. So if you're even younger and looking to secure a permanent policy, it may be worthwhile to take a look at what the cost would be to add or have that long-term care benefit attached to it. But if that's not something you want to do early in life with a permanent policy, then right around the age of 50 is when you should start exploring or thinking about that long-term care conversation.
So when we're looking to our day-to-day, because a lot of these topics can be overwhelming to families who are just trying to kind of make it through the week, right? Mm. How much time do you think that people should just in general be dedicating to having these conversations and to financial planning?
Well, they're uncomfortable conversations because nobody enjoys talking about their death or disability. But, if they have an advisor, it's something that should be spoken about at least once a year. In terms of if they don't, when there are life events, when you change jobs, buy a house, have a child, those are all key times to take a look at, review, and see if you have the right mechanisms in place. One of the other things you should be doing during those time periods as well is making sure that if you have these things in place, that the beneficiaries are right. I can't tell you how many times that we've worked with a couple where they got married 2 years ago and the husband or the wife still has their parents as the beneficiary of their life insurance policy.
Oh, wow.
So during those life events, you should be checking all those things.
Yeah, or an ex-spouse or, some of those kind of things. We're visiting with Larry Sprung about insurance and how to incorporate that into our financial plan. And I've appreciated, Larry, for some, I think you hit this on the head where for some, these are really difficult conversations because it's admitting your own mortality that like, hey, at some point I will likely need, some sort of life insurance or long-term care. And
I don't want to think about it.
Yeah, we skirt around the subject. I don't want to think about that. Or it can be so overwhelming that our eyes sort of gloss over and we go, insurance, yeah, I know I should. I'm just not going to deal with it.
Or if I may interject, too, a lot of times we think, well, I have life insurance with my company or my mm-hmm. I know I have a policy or whatever, but it might not be enough to get through a big critical financial event.
Yeah. There are several options, and I would be curious to know, I've heard of both whole life insurance as well as term life insurance. What are the differences between the two, or what are each of the two? And then is there one that is better?
Yeah. So, let's start with the last question first. Better depends upon the person. Basically, term insurance is thinking about it in terms of your renting coverage. You're renting coverage for a period of time, 10, 20, 30 years. So you'll have that coverage in place for that period of time. At the end of that period, it's going to go away. That tends to be a lot less expensive. Whole life, however, tends to be more of a permanent solution to that insurance. So, it's going to be much more expensive. So, for example, if you have a $500,000 term policy versus a $500,000 whole life, the term policy is going to expire at some point, and you're going to lose that coverage, where the whole life will stay with you as long as you're making those premiums. It's going to cost you substantially more. So, typically a good starting point for most people is that term insurance coverage, because it will get them the coverage they need at the lowest cost per thousand or cost for the death benefit as possible, versus the whole life. Where whole life starts coming in is if there's a more permanent need for the insurance, if there's other motivating factors like you want to build cash value and have a separate pool of money that you're accumulating. But typically, we recommend, you need the coverage. So, you know, at least get the term coverage in place, have it there, your least expensive route, and then reevaluate over time.
Yeah. You know, I will just say, too, as far as my own experience is it was one day meeting with some lawyers and financial advisors, and it was an uncomfortable few hours. It was about 4 hours of answering some really uncomfortable questions. Ooh. Like, well, when this happens, if you die first, if your spouse dies first, if, you know, you have this catastrophic event or whatever, and it would come up with all these scenarios, and you'd answer all these different questions about what you wanted, but then it was done. You know, then the majority of it was decided, you know, the beneficiaries. And then if you both die, then what will happen to your children? And when do you want them to get, you know, money? And when do you want that, you know, all this kind of thing where you do have to answer some, you know, uncomfortable sort of scenarios. But once it's done, it's taken care of. And, you know, you have that peace of mind that your wishes would be taken care of. And really, just reviewing it, like you said, when you have different life events, or every 3 to 5 years, you know, as your kids get older, or, you know, depending on if your situation changes, like they're financially dependent on you or less dependent on you, or what, you know, what, so many things happen. Just an uncomfortable few hours, just to have like an overall peace of mind, is worth taking that time to give you that peace of mind, and for your family in the future, it's worth doing. And I will also say, too, there's something available for anybody on any budget. You know, when we were having children and our children were young, my husband was working full-time. I was a stay-at-home parent. You know, he was in school. I mean, there wasn't a lot of money to go around, but right, there are policies and things that you can have just for that peace of mind on pretty much any budget.
That is absolutely true. I mean, you know, you don't have to go out and buy a $5 million policy when you're 27 years old and you just got married or something,
right, right,
you know, along those lines. You know, and it's something that even if you take a 20-year term policy, it doesn't mean you're going to have that policy for 20 years.
Right.
You know, over the last 20 years, I've redone my insurance probably 3 or 4 times. So it's not like you're stuck. It's not a set it and forget it. It's something that you want to reevaluate, and you can change over time and increase the coverage or decrease it if that makes sense for you and your situation as well.
And if you want to find out more about what Midland Financial can do for you, you can go to MidlandFinancial.com. Why do I bring that up? Well, we've been visiting with Larry Sprung, who is the CEO and founder of Midland Financial. He can help answer questions, as he is a certified financial planner and loves to talk about this very subject with those he works with. Larry, thanks for being on the show and breaking it down in a way that people can understand and also feel motivated to take care of this.
This is your daily reminder, too, to go over to BYUradio.org to enter for a chance to win Lisa's Adventure Club. That's right. We're giving away an annual National Parks Pass every week, all summer long, as part of our Adventure Club, trying to get everyone to get out and connect with nature, connect with your friends and your family, whoever you take there, and have an adventure. Get out and do something fun. Now, you can enter to win a lot of different ways, and we give you a lot of different opportunities. But really, the sentiment right now is just do it. Maybe you've been putting it off, but now, today is the day to enter for that chance to win.
Maybe entering in all the ways seems overwhelming.
Oh,
just pick,
sure.
Just pick one of the ways. You can go to BYUradio.org. One of those ways is by entering the word of the week. It's camera.
Oh, you said it the right way.
Debatable.
I've been saying camera. And
oh, you,
camera.
See, now you said it the right way.
But
perfect.
I said it like a robot.
I am camera. BYUradio.org is the website where you can go and put that in. Share it with your friends on social. That's a great thing, too. And may I share this pro traveler tip?
Oh, please.
Here's what you do.
Okay.
You go to BYUradio.org. Mm-hmm. You enter to win. Oh, my goodness. You won. How exciting for you.
Yeah.
And then you get back to your family and say, hey, family, there are national parks in Hawaii, and I just made it more affordable for us to be able to do that. Or if you've ever wanted to see places like Alaska, some of the greatest and largest national parks, it doesn't have to be those. I mean, there are 5 in the state where we live. I would go to any of them right now if I could and had an annual National Parks Pass. Go to BYUradio.org and enter to win today.
And speaking of national parks, we're talking about Lake Mead National Park. That's coming up next.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Thank you for listening to The Lisa Show. In the Nevada desert sits the beautiful Lake Mead. The Lake Mead National Recreation Area is America's first national recreation area. Have you heard about it?
Of course, and it's been in the news a bit, so I'm excited to be able to talk about what people can experience at the Lake Mead National Recreation Area, all as part of Lisa's Adventure Club.
And here to share everything we need to know is Lori Blalock. She's the founder of the website Southerner Says, a Georgia-based website that focuses on travel and road trips in North America. Welcome, Lori.
Hi, good morning. Happy to be here.
I'm glad. Can you describe for those of us who have not had the privilege of going to the Lake Mead National Recreation Area what it looks like and how much of it is the lake takes up and what else we can do there?
Well, Lake Mead Recreation Area is a huge park, but a very diverse park. I know the lake is what normally comes to people's minds, but it is 1.5 million acres in the middle of the Mojave Desert, and that is one of the driest deserts in North America. But the park includes portions of the Colorado River, and besides Lake Mead, you have Lake Mojave, which is formed by the Davis Dam down in the southern part of the park near Bullhead City, Arizona. So you have canyons, buttes, mesas, Joshua trees. You have a little bit of everything. And then the lake is about 550 miles of shoreline, according to the National Park Service. So the lake is rather large, but the park itself is huge.
Wow.
And so I mentioned that it's been receiving a lot of national attention. I know earlier this week they talked about the bathtub ring at Lake Mead. Can you tell people what that is?
That is the ring where the water, you can see the where the water once was and then how much it's dropped. And so there's a different color in the sediment in the rock that surrounds the lake. So they call it a bathtub ring because it kind of looks like a dirty bathtub. So you can't see how high that water was at one time.
How concerned are you about the water levels right now?
It's pretty concerning. It's very concerning. I was, I think I had mentioned the pre-interview that my daughter is there in the area, mm-hmm. and she was sending me some pictures last night, and and I think we're going to talk about this a little bit later, about how things have been affected this year, but there are several of the marinas and boat launches and things like that are being affected that you cannot use this year. So it is very concerning because you can definitely see the water really weakly drying up.
That's so sad. And let's talk about that then, because I would assume that a lot of people go there specifically to boat. What can they do right now?
Well, you can still boat. There are just some of the marinas that are having to close, that the water is just too low for them to even extend the marina down for them to launch. I know that they had done some of that earlier in the year. They had made some modifications to some of the areas, but some of them now it's just too much to even to be modified. They've just had to close some of those.
Wow.
So when we talk about being able to enjoy that recreation, you point out that a lot of people think of the lake, but there are so many other different opportunities, the buttes and the vistas and those kind of things. What are your favorite kind of maybe off the beaten path or unspoken of secrets mm-hmm. and treasures?
Well, a lot of people are familiar with Valley of Fire State Park around Las Vegas, and a lot of people don't know that Lake Mead National Recreation Area also has its own Redstone hiking area. It's on the north shore of the lake, so it's not one of the more heavily trafficked areas, but it's a beautiful area where people can get a taste of those red rocks that mm-hmm. Valley of Fire is so known for, and it's a very easy hiking area. There's a loop trail there. There's a newly installed picnic area. There's restrooms, which are always important.
Yep.
It's an easy area to get to and see without having to maybe make the trek to Valley of Fire or go into the state park, or for just people that are looking for something a little bit off the beaten path.
Right. So is that the suggestion that you would make if someone only had one day to visit the park?
Well, I think if someone has only one day and you were coming from Vegas, which uh-huh. a lot of people would be doing, I would enter into the park and do the Lake Shore. The North Shore goes along the north part of the park, but Lake Shore connects you through Henderson. And I would probably drive that first. There's a lot of good overlooks and easy small walks and hikes off of North Shore Road. And you can also visit the marina from there, the main marina there at Boulder Beach. You can even go to the beach there and swim if you wanted to. If you didn't want to rent a boat or get out on the water, you can go for a swim. Also nearby there are the historic railroad trails, which is the old railroad tracks from when they built the dam. And so you can hike those. The National Park Services may turn those into trails. You get some of the best views of the lake on those trails. Again, those are very easy. You might spot some wildlife. And then nearby also is the National Park Services Visitor Center that you could visit. I think that that would all make up a good day. Drive across the Hoover Dam, walk across the Michael Callahan Pat Tillman Memorial Bridge. That's a free walk along the bridge there to get a bird's eye view of the dam. That would all be a very good one day for a family, for a couple, for whoever they wanted to drive over from Las Vegas.
Oh, wow.
Now, you mentioned what with it being in the center of the desert. That makes me think that the summertime would be real hot and terrible. Is that the fact? Is there a better time of year to go there?
Well, it is hot. I don't think there really is a bad time, but yes, if you're going to go in the summer, it's going to be hot. It is that dry heat. You know, a lot of people say that dry heat is different. And coming from the South, it is a different heat. You know, we have the 100% humidity here. And so it is a different heat when you're out there in the summer. I like to go in May, the first part of June. The weather still hasn't gotten extremely hot. But also the fall is really nice. The fall of the year, like October, late October, early November, the weather is perfect. Beautiful weather at that time of the year.
And what kind of amenities are in the park? Do we need to bring in our own food and water, or are there places along the way that we could stop?
There are places along the way. In fact, in the marina there at Boulder Beach that I mentioned, the Boulder Beach Marina, there is a restaurant there. So that would also be part of your, if you wanted to go for the day, have lunch at the marina. You get to look at the boats. There's also a paddle boat, the Desert Princess, I think it's called. So they do a sunset and a dinner cruise, so if someone wanted to include that, that gets you out on the water. And then you're also really close to Boulder City, which was the city where the workers lived when they were building the dam. So there's plenty of restaurants. There's even a casino in the park. So there's plenty of places. You could bring your food, of course, and have a picnic at one of the beautiful areas, but there's food available.
Is there a sort of signature dish or something that, you know, people go and, you've got to have this if you go over to Boulder Beach Marina?
At the restaurant there? Well, they have a good breakfast. I've been for breakfast and lunch. I can't really think of a signature dish right off of the top of my head, but they do have a good breakfast, and it's kind of like a local feel. You have people that live there in that area or live on their boats or stay on their boats or there a lot. So you kind of get that kind of like a neighbor local feeling there. I find that whole area.
Oh, that's nice.
In Boulder City, kind of had that small town camaraderie. They're very proud of the dam building. A lot of the art and the things in the town refer to that building of the dam. So it's a really nice feel there in that area.
We're talking with Lori Blaylock, who is the creator of Southerner Says. I almost said that like a Southerner. Did you notice that?
I did. Sort of, with a little drawl.
I got that little drawl in there.
You're getting the accent already.
It's working.
You're rubbing off on me, Lori. A question that we have asked, because we do this segment every Thursday here on The Lisa Show, where we sort of explore into some of the great national recreation areas and national parks within our country and really try and inspire folks to be able to get out and try and see something new. One of the things that we have brought up with folks is the loving our national recreation area and parks lovingly in a way that allows them to continue in the future. How do you feel like we could best do that as we experience these places?
Well, I kind of think there should be some education. We have a lot of people that are getting out into the park in the last couple of years that maybe haven't traveled to the parks that much anymore. And I think a lot of people have a tendency to look at them as more of a amusement park type place, and they definitely are not that. So one of the most important things that people can do when they head out to the park is to make sure they know the 7 principles of leave no trace. And so there are seven kind of rules, laws of leave no trace. One of the most important things is, you know, have your plan ahead, prepare. You only travel, walk, camp where you're supposed to, where you're allowed. You dispose of your waste. You leave what you find. You don't take anything home with you out of the park. You leave everything. You respect wildlife. You consider others. And you just try to minimize your impact on the parks so that they will be around and we can all enjoy them for years to come.
Yeah, it's such a great reminder, you know, for all of us just to think about that before you go in, and that you are leaving it better for other people and other visitors and other generations to be able to enjoy it as well.
And especially a park like Lake Mead National mm-hmm. Recreation Area, because it is a recreation area. It's the same rules that a national park would have, but it's more of an open, less traffic. There's more room to cause damage, because I don't think people are thinking about it in that way, because it is kind of a, you know, a looser area, bigger area. So you might have the tendency, oh, well, I'll go here, or I'll grab this or do that. But it's not that way. We need to respect all the parks the same, no matter of the designation, if it's a recreation area, monument, park, whatever, we still have to respect them.
Well said.
Now, Lori, you talk about travel all over North America. I would be curious, and this is sort of out of the purview of the Lake Mead National Recreation Area, where are some other places that you have really enjoyed being able to visit and then subsequently write and share with folks?
Oh, boy.
I know. Pick a favorite. I know you have kids, too, so I'm going to need you to pick a favorite child as part of this as well.
Are you talking about parks, other parks?
We're just looking for inspiration. So it can be a park or a rec area or a monument, even just places to get out and try.
Well, as far as parks, if you happen to be in Nevada, one of the least visited national parks is Great Basin, kind of in the central part of the state. That's a great trip, about 5 hours north of Las Vegas. So it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. A lot of people don't go there because it's not that easy mm-hmm. to get to. It's not that easy to just plan a road trip with that. But that's a great park. I know even myself, I have a tendency to overlook and not talk about places in the South. I'm here in the South and don't really get to the South, don't really talk about it that much. But, you know, there's some great places in the South. And it seems everybody wants to head west and travel west, but mm-hmm. there's some great road trips in the South, some civil rights sites in the park system or that are handled by the state in Alabama, even Montgomery, Alabama. I was just recently in South Carolina in an area called the Old 96 area, which includes five different counties in western South Carolina. There's plenty of lakes. Again, there's three lakes that were formed by a dam, and you've got a lot of these cute little historic towns, lots of fishing, boating. That's a great area. There was so few people there, you could really get away from some of these more popular spots. I mean, I think we all need to kind of widen out and get away from some of these overly trafficked sites and parks like Zion and, you know, that are being loved to death, as you said.
You bring up some really good points and ways that we can just consider our impact on where we visit and kind of think outside the box. So I appreciate your time. I'm wondering for our time with you is coming to a close. How can visitors, get into the park? How have things changed because of COVID? What do we need to know before we make that plan?
Well, thankfully, they are running almost as normal this year. The biggest thing, as we've already talked about, is the water level that's closed some of those marinas and some of those boat launches. But the visitor center is back open. There are ranger-led programs being held again this year. One of the most exciting things that I think they're doing this year is twice a month they're doing a dark sky program.
Cool.
So if you're there with the family or those are wonderful programs in the park. I've only been to those once at Glacier National Park, which is another great park to visit mm-hmm. In Montana. But the rangers are back working on some of these programs. So COVID is not really affecting it too much this year. It's easy. The park is easy to get to from Las Vegas, or if you're coming from Arizona, it's very easy. There are several entrances So the park is super easy to get into. You can spend about $25 for a weekly or for a pass that lasts for 7 consecutive days, or you can buy an annual pass just to Lake Mead National Recreation Area for $45. But while you're at it, if you're going to visit some parks, why not go ahead and spend that $80 on the America the Beautiful National Park Pass, which gets you into over 2,000 interagency sites for $80 for a year. That's your best bet. You can, and in a lot of the parks, there are special designated lanes for park pass holders, and you get into the parks.
You just breeze by and you
I
go,
love it.
Pass holder here. Sorry,
yep.
guys.
I heading got the passport.
In. Lori Blaylock, creator of Southerner Says, you can find out more about Lori's travels if you follow at Southerner Says on Twitter. Also find her over on Instagram. You can also use the hashtag Road Trip Chat on Monday nights, and we appreciate her being here on the show. You can also go to BYURadio.org and enter to win, so you don't even have to spend that $80.
No, you're
going to
save
win
a lot of money if you
an
win.
Annual National Parks Pass from Lisa's Adventure Club.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on the BYU Radio app, or you can listen on demand. You can also find us on Sirius XM channel 143.
If you like something you heard, you want to share it with your friends, a great way to do that, share the Lisa Show podcast, available wherever you, yes, you, I'm talking to you. I know you're looking around going, is he talking to me? Yeah, you, wherever you get your podcast.
On tomorrow's show, we're going to learn how to encourage our kids' entrepreneurial spirits with lemonade stands.
Thank you for making The Lisa Show a part of your day.